All right, we're on concept number 26, the eyes of faith. Notes are on your table. If you weren't here last week, we began an eight-week segment on strengthening your core, and the topic we'll be looking at for the next several weeks is this particular topic on faith. And let me get these up here for you. Last week we looked at a single verse in the Bible that's found four different places, but it's essentially the same verse. Habakkuk 2:4, which says, "The righteous man shall live by faith." Now, in that verse, there is an adjective to describe the word faith there that you might not have noticed. It says, "The righteous man shall live by his faith." By his faith. So if we all have faith, it is a gift from God, and it's one of our great possessions to be able to have that, because not everyone is able to receive the gospel. Not everyone is able to live by faith. And so if we have been given that ability, then that's one of our most precious possessions, and we want to learn how to nurture and to cultivate and protect our faith. If our faith runs aground and we shrink back into unbelief and anxiety and fear, it shuts down our relationship with God, and the life-giving power of His presence is lost upon us. We talked about that at length last week. Now, tonight, what I hope to do is to try to convince you, as compellingly as I can, that your faith is of great value to you, and you want to do everything you can to protect it. Now, how many of you said a minute ago in the survey, I'm trying to remember, that you would give up your eyesight of the five? Okay, a couple of you agreed to do that. Now, most of you want to hang on to your eyesight, okay? So your physical eyes are important to you, yeah? How much more your spiritual eyes? You have reasons why you wouldn't want to give up your physical eyesight. Now, that matters a lot to you. In the same token, your spiritual eyes are even that much more important. So tonight we're going to angle our discussion in this direction, and I trust that you'll find this a beneficial topic. I enjoyed putting it together this week. I'm going to go through concept 23. Now, key verse that we looked at last week, used four different places in the New Testament, is Habakkuk 2:4. "Behold, as for the proud one," or the puffy one, "he is not right within himself, but the righteous man shall live by his faith." Now, upon this little obscure verse that's found in a minor prophet in the Old Testament, Paul and the writer of the Hebrews quotes that verse three times in a major doctrine called justification by faith, is built upon this single verse. And we will get to that major cardinal doctrine later, but we'll let this verse introduce us or get us into the topic, and let's say it all together. The righteous man shall live by faith. Let's say it again. The righteous man shall live by faith. All right, great verse. Now, last week's summary goes like this. There are two vantage points that we start from in life. There is the self-centered vantage point, where we're centered upon our own self-perspective. And we, from that perspective, end up looking down. We tend to look down with prideful superiority, full of oneself, in a self-justifying manner that leads us down a lethal pathway. We tend to be high-minded and think of ourselves as being right. Anybody that disagrees with us is wrong. And we follow down that pathway, and it takes us in a direction that we don't want to go. Versus the self-centered way of living, there is the God-centered way of thinking. The God-centered worldview that, rather than looking down with prideful superiority, when our lives are God-centered, we're looking up from a position of subordination. So we're looking up instead of down, which is a more humble position, and we're fixed upon God, not fixed upon ourselves. Instead of being full of ourselves, we're fixed upon God. And we're living out a faith righteousness that leads us down a life-giving pathway. And in the New Testament, it is this self-justifying or works righteousness that's so often contrasted with faith righteousness, the one leading one leading us in a direction that we don't want to go, and the other leading us in a direction we need to go. So a faith righteousness is a righteousness that's based upon faith. In other words, we're justified in the eyes of God by putting our faith in Jesus and His perfect righteousness versus putting our faith and our trust in our own self-righteousness in hopes that that will justify us before God. So these two perspectives are the points of departure that come from this verse. The puffy one is full of himself. He's not right. On contrast to that, the righteous person shall live by faith. So it is a faith that saves us, sustains us, steadies us, and empowers us. It is faith that brings life, the transfusion of life, into our relationship with God. We must not shrink back into ourselves through doubt, fear, anxiety, anger, or unbelief, but press forward in faith until we reach our heavenly destination. So it's faith. Faith is the linchpin in that mindset that drives us forward so that our faith remains healthy. Faith is the core of our connection with God, and the aim of this next segment of study is to strengthen our core of faith. If faith is that strand or that cable or that bond that brings God to life within us, then if we lose that bond, then we lose our sense of connection with God and everything goes south. So we're going to strengthen that core, or the idea of the next several weeks is to strengthen the core so that the eyes of faith are open. Now, here's a diagrammatic way of thinking about this, and sometimes the word pictures help you. And so I threw these in. Question being, what is your starting point in life? I was going to print this out and go over to Starbucks this week and just engage strangers at Starbucks and show them the sheet of paper. And life was so busy this week that I couldn't do it, but I'll do it eventually. So when we're trying to wrestle with life, let's begin with the starting point. What's your starting point? Okay, if your starting point is self, or is your starting point self at the center, and everything just sort of flows out of that, or is it God? Is God at your center? And that becomes your starting point for experiencing reality. God is at the center. Now, how does a person rise above oneself? If your starting point is yourself, and you feel the painful limitations of everything orienting around yourself, and you know how frustrating and exasperating that can be, how do you break the power of self and then begin to live out of a whole different orientation point, starting point? How does that actually work? How do we begin to center life around God? And the answer that the Bible gives us is by faith. We begin to center our lives around God, and it's our faith that enables us to break the power of self and to free to then begin to see from a whole different orientation. So these little diagrams kind of give you a feel for that. So in Ephesians 2:8-9, I've told you before, my wife was converted to Christianity through these two verses. Ephesians 2:8-9, which says, "By grace you're saved through faith, that not of yourselves, it's a gift of God, not as a result of works, that any man should boast." So we're saved from self by grace. And so we're saved by grace, but we live by faith. We live by faith. It's our faith that allows us to internalize the reality of God so that our faith connects us into the experience of God, and God begins to have His reign in our lives, and it's the power of God that reigns, not the power of sin, the power of evil, and the power of destruction. So we're saved by grace, but we live by faith. We're saved by grace, but we live by faith. And so we've kind of journeyed through the grace part in the early stages of Christianity examined. Now we're going to get to the faith part and spend some time on this. Okay? Now, definition of faith. There are concepts in the Bible that we are many times left to ourselves to read through and study the Bible and to formulate our own definitions of concepts, but faith is not one of those. Faith is a concept in the Bible that the Bible does in fact define. Now, this definition that we're about to look at is not a comprehensive definition. It doesn't say everything there is to say about faith, but it says enough to get us started on understanding the concept of faith and how it works its way into that core position in our spiritual lives. When we paraphrase, or let's go back to the verse, Hebrews 11:1, it says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. Definition we're given. Let's say that together, Hebrews 11:1. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. Now, if you look at the definition closely, what you see is that the verse has a present tense function and a future tense function. The present tense function is to be able to perceive what is now. That's the first part of it. Come in.
Can I have a
sure. Okay. Okay. All right. So there's the box. The first part of the definition deals with the present tense, being assured being persuaded of what is. And then the second part of the verse, which actually comes in a reverse order, is the ability to participate what is to come. So faith has to do with the present tense and the future tense. So faith, in a paraphrased way, we could say that faith is a firm persuasion of what is and is a confident anticipation of what is to come. So the faith has a present tense and a future tense orientation. That makes sense? See where I'm coming from? All right, let's keep going. Now, the word faith boiled down to even more could look something like this. Faith involves the ability to perceive the invisible. Faith involves the ability to perceive the invisible and to envision the unrealized, or to envision the not yet realized. So you can see from this little boil down definition that we're talking about the ability to see or perceive or to envision. So faith has to do with your ability to see what isn't there, what's not visible in a present tense and was it not yet here in a future tense. So faith has to do with the ability to perceive or to see. All right, definition of faith continued. As the old saying goes, seeing is believing, right? Well, in terms of everyday life, you can argue that. But in terms of the faith arena, that's not true. That is not true. We have to, we don't necessarily discount this as true in terms of the physical world, but it is true in terms of the spiritual world. Let's look at John chapter 20, verses 24 and 25. In this passage, this is on Resurrection Sunday, Jesus later in the day appears to the apostles, and they're in a locked room, bolted shut, an upper room where they feel safe in Jerusalem, and suddenly Jesus appears in their midst. And he says, peace be unto you, do not be afraid. And then he breathes upon them and he says, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. And so suddenly Jesus, the resurrected Christ, is in the midst of the startled, traumatized disciples, and there he is. And so they're in shock and amazement, and after a period he leaves. And Thomas wasn't with them, but he comes in a few minutes later. And when Thomas walks in the room, they said to Thomas, they reported to him, Thomas, we've seen the Lord. And Thomas is famous for his doubting Thomas statement, unless I put my fingers in his side, so forth, I'm not going to believe that he's real. I'm not going to believe it. I don't care what you say. I'm not going to believe it. So 7 days later, Jesus comes back, and this time Thomas is in the room. And Jesus says, Thomas, come over here for a second. See these cross wounds here? Stick your finger in there. See this sword wound in my side? Stick your hand in it. And be not unbelieving, but being believing. And of course, Thomas says, my Lord and my God. Thomas didn't have to go through the ritual that he said he was going to go through. He realizes the error of his way. And that's when Jesus says, look at the verse up here. It says, because you have seen me, do you believe? Blessed are those who do not see and believe. In other words, blessed are those who perceive my presence by faith. Faith is the ability to perceive what's invisible. or what is to come, so to speak. So here Jesus commends those who believe and they don't see. In other words, they don't have physical evidence to prove the existence of what they see. Now, going back to our little saying up here about seeing is believing, in our rationalistic, scientific-driven culture, you're ridiculed if you believe something you can't see or prove. That's how you're treated. And so in the realm of faith and in the realm of spiritual things, the opposite is true. The counterintuition is true. So here Jesus is commending those who aren't able to see but believe. So faith is that ability to perceive what's real and be able to see it in a way that is not present to the five senses. Now in 1 Peter 1:8, we have almost an exact paraphrase of this idea. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 8. It says, "And although you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory." Now, those of us that tend to be rationalistic and tactile oriented, it's hard for us to understand spiritual reality. But notice how we are commended here, that even though we don't see him, we love him. And even though we have not seen him, we love him. And even though we do not see him now, you believe in him. So Peter was in that upper room when Thomas was there the second time Jesus appeared to the grieving disciples. And Jesus says, "Oh, you've seen me, so yeah, you believe. But how much more blessed are those who believe and don't see?" And Peter quotes him here decades later. Same idea. So in the realm of faith, do we have to see to believe? No. In fact, if you're waiting to see to believe, you may not ever believe. Because faith involves believing what you can't see and anticipating what is not here yet. And we talked last spring about the promises of God and how we have to wait for the promises to be fulfilled. But by faith, we can appropriate the benefit of the promises today, even though they're not fulfilled till in the future. So this is how faith enables us to enjoy the benefits of something that hasn't even arrived yet, or something we can't see. All right, let's keep going. In 2 Corinthians 5:7, it says, "We walk by faith and not by sight." We walk by faith and not by sight. So you can see the flow of thought here centering around faith being the ability to see with eyes of the heart, not with the eyes of the body. Now, let's develop this a little bit further. When we talk about knowledge versus faith, knowledge is that ability to view or consider something to be real, true, or right. When we say we know something, what we're saying is that we believe it to be real, or we believe it to be true, or we believe it to be right. I know this is true. I know this is real. I know this is right. And we live on the basis of that. Okay? Now, knowledge is at the heart of faith. Knowledge is at the heart of faith. But knowledge goes beyond faith. Knowledge evolves into faith when we move from the seen realm to the unseen realm. In other words, we know that physical things exist because we've got five senses to tell us that they're there. And it enables us to perceive that they're there. So we have a knowledge based upon what the senses tell us. But when you move out of the physical realm to the spiritual realm, then you move from knowledge to faith. Because while knowledge can be based upon what you can perceive to be true, faith is based upon what you can't demonstrate with the five senses. It's the invisible spiritual realm. So knowledge evolves into faith when you move from the seen world to the unseen.
When you say the spiritual realm is unseen, what if you do see in the spiritual?
You mean have visions? Well, God grants that to you sometimes. But that's not the faith that you live by. Those are experiences that God grants to us occasionally, but you don't build your life necessarily around those.
They do build your faith, though.
They can. And we have to discern that they're of God, because not everything that glitters is gold when it comes to that stuff. But yes, that's a good question. Okay, let's keep going. Knowledge applies to the physical world, what is seen or tangible. Faith applies to the spiritual world, what is unseen or intangible. Faith is to the heart, what the eyes are to the body. It is the ability to see reality. It's the ability to see reality. Faith is to the heart what the eyes are to the body, the ability to see. Faith, in other words, is your spiritual vision, your ability to perceive that something exists or to perceive that something is coming your way that has been promised by God or spoken by God. And by faith, you're able to appropriate that into your life. Now, let's use this little diagram. And you got to fill in the word no up here in your diagram. You got to fill it into your diagram on your sheet. The word no is the one that's missing. Now, when we're in the physical world, we have the ability to know that the physical world exists around us in various shapes, forms, sizes, etc. And it is the five senses that enable us to perceive that, to know that. But if you live only within a closed physical system, your perception of reality is drastically limited. Watch. Look at this. When you move from the physical realm, where you rely upon your senses to tell you what's there, you move, if that's what you're limited to, and the field of atheism today would say that's all we're limited to, we're in a like closed materialistic system, and we can only see what we perceive with our senses. That's all that there is. There's nothing beyond, and when this goes away, then we go away with it. But the Bible brings out a much larger, expansive dimension of reality. And to perceive that or to see that, we have the eyes of faith. So the physical realm, based upon the senses, gives us knowledge. When it moves to the spiritual realm, you move out of the realm of knowledge to faith. And this is called, philosophically, the leap of faith that many people aren't willing to make because it's just too uncertain to move from the physical world to the spiritual world and to assume that the spiritual world is there, not tangible to the senses, so therefore I'm not going to put any stock in that. But what the Bible says is, yes, you move from the physical to the spiritual simply by virtue of faith. When your knowledge is foundational and your faith is on top of that, you're able to see beyond the normal physical world. Okay, so this is what it looks like. Now, let's go to the alternative to faith. Let's assume faith is not something we're going to embrace or we're going to believe. Now, watch what happens when we take a rationalistic view of life. Hebrews 11:6. This is five verses later from the Hebrews 11:1 definition of faith. And so what the writer of the Hebrews is trying to do is say, here's what faith is, and let me show you what the alternative is and what impact a lack of faith has upon your relationship with God. Now watch how this verse unfolds. It says in Hebrews 11:6, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Not much alternative there. Without faith, it's impossible to please God, for he who comes to God must believe two things. First, that he is. We must believe that God exists. And number two, that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. So not only does he exist, but he rewards those who seek him. In the first session this afternoon, we were talking about Matthew 6:33. Which says, seek ye first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. And we looked at probably 25 verses that talk about seeking God and the value of seeking God spiritually and putting the spiritual pursuit of God above the physical pursuit of survival, and how God promises to add what we need to our lives physically if we pursue him by priority first spiritually. We already talked about that. Now, here we've got this. We've got the same idea of seeking God or coming to God, and there's two underlying assumptions that will draw us in a Godward direction. First of all, we got to believe that God is there, and secondly, we have to believe, or we need to believe that he's a God who will, you will benefit from seeking him. There's benefit to that. He will reward you. So let's break the verse down, and we'll take a look at it now. All right. Notice it starts with the phrase "without faith." The word without here means excluded from or apart from. In other words, if you exist alone and apart from faith, if that's where you are, and by the word faith, we'll just use a simple definition here, without belief in God, without faith in God, certain things become impossible. Certain things become undoable. The word impossible here is the word dunatos, which means power negated. So power makes things possible. A dunatos means the opposite of that. We are powerless to do certain things. So without faith, we are powerless. Without faith, we are disempowered from certain things. Faith has a disempowering effect upon our perspective on life. Notice it says, it is impossible, we are powerless to please God. There's no way we can please God. And the word here for please is a compound word which symbolizes intensity of thought. So the idea of living a life that's pleasing to God can't happen without faith. Faith is the springboard into a life that allows us to live a life that's well-pleasing to Him. So we're told at the beginning the alternative to faith is going to cause a massive breakdown in your relationship with God if you don't have it. Without faith, certain things can't happen. All that goes into living a life that honors and pleases God, all that's off the table once our faith dies, is taken away from us, or when we shrink back from it. But on the other hand, notice how the verse is a contrast of thought. It says, but those who come to God, and the word come here is a participle word, that is a grammatical construction that speaks of continuous present tense action. Those who come to God, those who move toward Him, are those who seek God out. Those who seek Him, pursue Him. Those who come to God must. Doesn't say may, but it says must. And the word must here is a binding logical necessity. In other words, it is necessary for the person who comes to God to do these two things. First of all, to believe or to have faith that God exists. Faith starts there. If faith is going to have any benefit whatsoever, then we have to start with the assumption that God exists. If we're going to have faith in a God that doesn't exist, of course, that's illogical and irrational. But if we're going to have faith and we're going to come to God, then let's first accept that He does exist. And that number two, He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. Now notice how this phrase breaks out. This is pretty dynamic. This is a dynamic idea. What it says is that if we're going to come to God in faith, we first believe that He is. And then secondly, here's what we believe about this God that we're seeking. What we want to believe is that He rewards those who seek Him. The word reward here means to award benefits or one who pays back. And it's sort of the idea of you making an investment and getting return on your investment. So there's a sense in which faith means investing yourself in your relationship with God, and that brings huge dividends. That's what it's saying. It says He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. Now the word seek here, let me finish the thought and I'll take your question. The word seek is a present active participle, similar to the word we used up here, comes to Him. And the present active participle denotes one who's seeking until he finds. In other words, you seek until you find what you're looking for. You lose something, you're not going to stop till you find it. You ever had those experiences where you get up, you're ready to go to work today, and you can't find your keys? So you better get busy finding your keys or you're not going anywhere. So you look until you find your keys. And at that point, your search is over. You've exhausted your search. Okay, well, this idea of seeking God, that God rewards those who seek Him, refers to people who seek Him until they find Him, and they don't stop until they find Him. And when there's that pursuit, when there's that dogged pursuit of God in God's will and God's perspective, He's going to reward that. Now, the best way I can illustrate this intense idea of seeking, I think I've told you this story before. It goes like this. There was a disciple of a wise man one time who went to the wise man and said, I want to be as wise as you are. And the wise man said, you sure? He said, yeah. I really want to be just like you. I want to be as wise as you are. And the wise man said, well, come with me then. So the wise man takes this wannabe wise man to a body of water. I don't know whether it was a lake or a pool or the ocean. And he takes the disciple who wants to be wise like him and sticks his head down underwater. And he holds his head underwater. The guy starts to squirm and push when he's being deprived of oxygen. And he won't let him out of the water. He's holding him underwater. And the guy's squirming all over the place and thrashing about. And he's trying to get his head up for oxygen. And then finally, after a reasonable length of time, the wise man lets his head up out of the water. And he says, now, when you want wisdom as much as you just wanted oxygen, you'll become a wise man. It's that intensity of pursuit that you must demonstrate if you want to become wise. And that's what the word is talking about here. You will seek it until you find it. You know it exists, and you're not going to give it up till it's in your hands. You will pursue it until you find it. So God is a rewarder of those who seek Him with that level of intensity. Now, Susie, you had a question or a comment? What kind of benefits he gives back?
Yeah, you said if you seek him like that,
well, let me let you answer that question. You have undoubtedly sought God, and He's rewarded that by giving you wisdom, by giving you wisdom, by revealing things about Himself to you, by giving you peace, confidence in decision making.
So
that makes sense. Yes. Yeah. The benefit of you seeking Him is that He will give you what you ask for and then the confirmation of what goes with that. Yeah, that's the idea. Thank you. Okay. Now, you see the verse here is the alternative to faith is unbelief. Unbelief has a completely disempowering effect upon our relationship with God in that we can't please Him. So, on the other hand, if we are going to have this relationship with God, then we've got to have a faith that draws us to Him. And that faith operates or is driven by two assumptions. I'm not pursuing open air. I'm pursuing a God who exists. And I'm going to spend effort and investment to find Him, because when I find Him, there's going to be great benefits that come with that. So, alternatives to faith look like this. If we don't have faith, we have a major spiritual power outage. We have a total shutdown. Powerlessness. The absence of faith causes a spiritual blackout. Places like New York City fear nothing more than when the power goes off. And hundreds of people are stuck in elevators. Remember those days? Real was with the United Nations in New York City for 25 years. And you remember those days when all of a sudden the city's brought to a standstill when there's no power. Scary thought. Well, when our faith fails, it's like a power outage. Everything goes black and nothing moves and you're stuck. And I've been at those places just a few times, but there's nothing more scary than being there. So, without faith, we have a spiritual blackout, so to speak, or outage. Faith empowers a person to seek God, believing that He is the God who's there, and that if we seek Him for help, we will be rewarded and not disappointed. We'll be glad we did it. We'll be happy that we did it. It will pay off based upon the effort we put into it. To those who seek Him, God becomes a rewarder. Now, Susie, going back to your question about how does God reward us, there's a sense in which I can't really answer that question, because this idea that God becomes a rewarder to those who seek Him implies that God is very creative with the way He does this. And God gets really creative with people who seek Him, and He designs nice little blessing packages for people who do that. And again, you've seen it in your life. If you live this out, you'll experience it. And when it happens, you'll just realize only God could have done it, or only God could have done it this way. And you'll be able to understand that when it happens. So when you seek God, assuming that He's there, and you're anticipating that He's going to reward you, God gets really creative. And you will have your stories to tell when you learn to seek Him and when you learn to live by faith. Let me tell you a quick, short one. To answer your question, Susie, a couple of weeks ago we started Christianity Examined on Thursday night, and we only had kind of one person initially confirmed to be here, and I would love to have spent Thursday night at home. So I'm thinking, Lord, should I cancel this thing or push it to Sunday or Saturday? And I couldn't decide what to do. So as the week wore on, five more people registered. So we had six people registered for Christianity Examined. But I couldn't confirm all that they were coming. I only had one confirmation. So I thought, okay, Lord, we're going to move forward by faith on this thing. And I hope I'm not sitting here on Thursday night talking to one person. I hope that's not the case. Well, anyway, Thursday night rolls in and there are six people signed up. Five of them don't show. One person's here. But four people walked in the door that hadn't registered. And then another person came this past week. So we have a small group of about 13 people with six guests. But I'm not sure any of these six have a relationship with God. So I almost canceled that because I couldn't confirm who was coming. And I just remember saying, Lord, I don't have anything to go on here. We'll just do it. And now we've got six people. And the chemistry of this Thursday night group has gelled remarkably in 2 weeks. I mean, the difference between from week one to week two is really shocked by. And three more people were supposed to show up last week, the second week, and none of them came. So it was the same six and the host and the table leaders. But the thing gelled together in a way. And I thought, okay, God, you're doing some business here. So that's an example of you can't discern exactly what to do. So you say, okay, Lord, by faith, I'm going to plow ahead. And let's see what happens. So, surprise, surprise. There you go. For to those who seek Him, God becomes a rewarder. And we want to give God opportunities to reward us, Donna, by trusting in Him, seeking Him, versus trying to work stuff out ourselves. Does you kind of get the idea here? Give it to God, and let's seek God and trust God, and let's see what He does. Remember, He's very creative. Donna? Well, your point of reference is shut down in terms of God, so you're back to your depraved, sinful self, and that can lead you in any number of directions, because that's all you have at this point. I mean, it's really, really a scary place to be when you can't connect with God. And you know He's there, but you can't connect with Him. The phrase dark night of the soul refers to that period of time you go through when you lose contact with God. And it's not necessarily that there's sin in your life, but you're just going through a stretch of the journey where you can't grasp hold of God. Called the dark night of the soul. Everybody will go through this at some point, and it's a really scary time when it happens. But yes, that's what it's talking about. All right, faith enables a person to seek God confidently and to wait for reward expectantly. This is the power that faith brings into our lives. And this is what we're down to when it says, but the righteous man shall live by faith. It is a faith that keeps the lights on, keeps the power going, so that the interactions we have with the spiritual realm is there. Now, let me take you to a quick passage, one book over from Hebrews to the book of James. And you want to let me finish first and ask, or do you want to ask it? You want to throw your monkey wrench in now? Or
I guess my question is,
yes. Well, I'm glad you asked. The verses right before this passage, in fact, say, count it all joy when you encounter various trials, because trials are the food of your faith. Now, that's the simple, unsympathetic answer to your question. So if you're struggling with something that's really overwhelming and you're weary by that, which we all hit stretches of weariness. My 40s were one long 10-year trial. All hell broke loose in my 40s. All kinds of bad things happened. The church I was pastoring got really ornery and difficult. And we had several family losses in terms of prenatal losses as a family. Cindy was grieving for 4 years and life just was brutal. I mean, it was like there was no safe place to go. Remember the... y'all watched the movie, Tom Hanks was in it, about D-Day. What's that thing called? Saving Private Ryan. Remember they're on the beach storming the Normandy beach, and one of the soldiers turns to whatever his name was in the movie, Tom Hanks, and he says something like, "Where? What do we do now? Or where do we go from here? Where's the safe place to go?"
Anywhere but here.
And he says, "Anywhere but here." Now, when you're in a stretch of trials where no place feels safe, not even where you are, now that's a tough place to be. Anywhere but here. And we're going to have those stretches where it just doesn't feel, nothing feels safe. There's nowhere to run and no place to hide. And you'll have those stretches. But according to the scripture, the corner turns. And there's lots of living examples of people who have been at that place where anywhere but here would be safe. And eventually the corner will turn in that. So James, the passage that precedes this passage, says, "Consider it all joy when you encounter trials, knowing that trusting is the food of your faith." So in answer to your question, how do muscles grow? Remember we talked about the muscle of faith? Trials put pressure on your muscles, or your spiritual muscles. So if you don't exercise, your muscles don't have any exercise. Lifting weights creates tension in your muscle system. And when you have to press weight, it creates tension in the muscle systems, which causes them to strengthen and grow. So trials have the same impact upon us. It puts pressure on our spiritual muscles, which causes them to strengthen and to grow. Solomon, think of the life of Solomon. Solomon died. When he died, he was miles from God. And Solomon had every one of his physical needs met and never had any trials in his life. His faith went to seed because of his flabbiness spiritually, with his faith never being tested. And the only time Solomon's mentioned in the New Testament, Jesus mentions him in reference to the lilies of the valley when he says, "Even the lilies of the valley are more beautiful than Solomon in all of his glory." In Solomon, all of his glory, there was deflation. There was silver wasn't worth anything in the days of Solomon. They had so much money. But Solomon, who wasn't tested, got distracted and his faith was weak. There was a lady I had to do her husband's funeral in Florida. And this lady had lost one husband to cancer, died. He died. She married another man. On a Sunday night, a couple of the workers in his business came over to their house to rough up the boss and cut his throat. It was on the evening news and I had to do the funeral. And I remember at the funeral, we're out in the sticks because she didn't want the press to find out about it. And she looked up to me and she said, "James, the pastor that did my first husband's funeral said this." I looked at her and I said, "How are you doing?" And she looked at me and she said, "James, the pastor who did the funeral for my first husband said, James, the only place where the sun shines all the time is a desert."
Is where?
A desert. It's a desert. So when our lives, where the sun shines all the time and everything's perfect, nothing grows there. It's a desert. So we're living in a world of good and evil. It's a fallen world. And trials will be woven into the fabric of everyday life to stretch us, to grow us, to strengthen us. So that's the simple answer to your question, Miss Vicki. Good question. Now, notice how this passage, the passage goes on where it talks about trials being the food of faith. And it goes on to say this. When you're dealing with trials, Vicki, and you can't quite get God's perspective on it, here's what the Bible says. If you can't figure out what God's doing, ask for wisdom. We ask God for wisdom. We can't understand this. We need wisdom. And it says, "But if any man lacks wisdom," which is seeing God, life through God's point of view, "let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it'll be given to him." But notice what the passage goes on to say now. This is very helpful. It says, "But let him ask in faith with no doubts." Let him ask in faith without any doubts. "For one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man expect to receive anything from God." Being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. So this passage outlines what happens to us when our faith is tested and we begin to waver underneath it and doubt creeps in. It causes us to be dual focused and double minded, and it creates an ambivalence and an instability in our lives. where the resting place is one of, God, I do not get this. I don't get this. This makes no sense to me. It's gone on too long. It's driving me to drink. Do something. But you get there and you just say, okay, God, I don't have anywhere to go but to look up. This is all I can do. This is all I can do. I remember when we lost the baby at 3 days of age, we all wrote letters to the baby and they were read at a funeral. And the letter I wrote to the baby said something like, it's a tragedy that we've lost you, but God is still good. And that's the message I wanted to send to my child in heaven and also to my congregation. That I don't get this. I don't understand why we went through 9 months of a pregnancy for a baby to die 3 days later. Is that you call that life? That's kind of a weird deal, to say the least. But even though this awfulness has happened, God is still good. That's faith. And if we get weak in faith, it causes ambivalence. We begin to waver, and we become unstable in all of our ways. So the alternative to faith is this ambivalent, curious mistake, or this rather ambivalent, unstable, double-mindedness that just splits us into 1,000 pieces and fragments us. And that's the impact that anxiety has upon us. It kind of blows us apart. So, again, the righteous man shall live by faith. Let's live by faith and box doubt out because it causes power outage in our spiritual journey. All right, here we go. Thoughts on faith. All right, we're to begin with, our relationship with God began by faith. For by grace you're saved through faith. That not of yourselves, it's a gift of God. So we're saved by faith. And number two, we live by faith. The righteous man shall live by his faith. And then 2 Corinthians 5:7, for we walk by faith and not by sight. Faith, therefore, is the eyes of the soul. So you don't want to give up your physical eyes, because when you do that, you lose contact with your ability to interact with the physical world. So we protect that physical eyesight, or life becomes exceedingly dangerous and unmanageable. Well, that's also what happens spiritually when faith begins to grow dim. You lose your vision. And when you can't see God and what He's doing, and you lose that ability to perceive that He is the God who's there, and that if you keep seeking Him, He's going to reward you seeking Him. If you lose that, then you hit the wall of anxiety, despair, and depression. And when you hit, I've seen very few people actually hit despair, but I've seen a few. And when a person hits the pit of despair, that is the most frightening thing imaginable. I mean, that's very scary to me. I don't feel competent to do anything other than pray for a person who hits that wall. I mean, that's a scary place. But what happens when you hit that wall, the way you get there is the erosion and the dissolution of your faith. Your faith is your eyesight. You've got to keep your eyes on God. And that when we are keep our eyes on God and seek Him, what we're told is He becomes a rewarder to those who seek Him. So with all the spiritual muster you've got, you seek God in those hard times and wait for the corner to turn. Wait for it to turn. The corner will turn. All right, discussion points. Now, here's what I want you to do at your tables. And you guys got to go to your small group, whatever you need to do. All right, first of all, what I want you to do at your table tonight, take a few minutes for this. I want you to come, from all that I've given you tonight, I want you to come up with some kind of a working definition for faith. What is faith for you? And then secondly, what I want you to do is identify some specific need or challenge in your life right now that is God-sized and you can't fix this. You can't fix it. You've got to put it in God's hands. It's just bigger than you are. And we're not meeting next week because it's Labor Day weekend, but the week after that, we will then move into how faith begins to operate in a world where our power is so limited and there's so much around us that is of concern to us. We will talk about how that begins to work itself out. But for this evening, what I want you to leave tonight with is, Just identify some specific burden in life right now that's just bigger than what you can deal with. And you're just going to have to, God's got, bring, we're going to bring God into whatever that is.